Good afternoon, Gregory Lansky, bar registration number 38515, for Mr. Rydell Dotson, through the Office of Alternative Defense Counsel. The first claim raised on appeal deal with the district court summarily denying Mr. Dotson's claim of ineffective assistance of the counsel as it relates to his claims of a fair cross section under the United States Constitution, the Colorado Constitution, the Colorado Uniform Jury Selection and Service Act. It's our position that the court committed error by summarily denying that claim without an evidentiary hearing. What was alleged in the post-conviction motion was that at the time of Mr. Dotson's trial in the year 2000, the portion of Aurora in Arapahoe County was excluded from the jury selection service in Arapahoe County. At the time of Mr. Dotson's trial, the percentage of African Americans was 12%, where in the rest of Arapahoe County it was 2.6%. It was 4.6 times greater, the African American percentage in Aurora County, than it was in the rest of Arapahoe County. Attached to the post-conviction motion was statistics that showed this was statistically significant. And the court denied this claim based on the case of Cepeda, based on the absolute disparity and comparative disparity numbers, to say it was less than what was alleged in Mr. Dotson's motion.
Actually, what the court did was rely on both Cepeda and Washington. And so I'm trying to understand what more the court could have done here. It acknowledged that it was considering all the statistics in the attachment to the motion, including the experts' data on statistical significance. It accepted all that as true, and then it said, as a matter of law, I think I'm bound here by Cepeda in Washington. So what more could it have done in a hearing?
The situation is that what the court did by relying on Cepeda, Cepeda is a 30-year-old precedent, it was decided in 1978. That court all relied on was just the absolute disparity and the relative and comparative disparity statistics. Since then, there's been studies that show that those statistics are not reliable, and essentially, you know, they cannot be relied upon, especially in the situation in Mr. Dotson's case, where the African-American percentage was not a very large percentage of the entire Arapahoe County. So I think the court could have relied on just that decision when based on those statistical measures, which have subsequently been said they have been faulted both by the Colorado Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court.
It didn't rely just on those. It considered all. It didn't do exactly what Washington told it to do. It said you got to look at all the statistics. Well, and he accepted them all as true, and he said, similar to Washington, I think this is more persuasive, and indeed the data is even less than has been approved by 10th Circuit cases and the Washington case. So I'm just trying to figure out what would happen in a hearing that the judge didn't already do when he looked at your motion.
Well, what would happen in here, we would have expert testimony explaining the importance of the statistical measure, a significant statistical significance. In Cepeda, that was not done. All that was analyzed was the absolute disparity and the comparative disparity.
It was done in Washington with the same expert.
It was the same expert. But in Washington, you have to understand, that took place in 2003, and it was a different system, jury selection, that was taking place in 2003 compared to 2000. In 2003, the Aurora jurors were getting ranked based upon their service in the Aurora Municipal Court. Prior to 2003, all the eligible jurors in Aurora, which was located in Arapahoe County, were entirely excluded. So it's a different situation here, and there's different statistics here. At this point, I think we could distinguish our case from the Washington case for the fact that this was systematic exclusion, where not just, like, you know, they were ranked. Everyone from Aurora was eligible to serve for jury were not included in that. And when you have a situation where the African-American population in Aurora is six times greater, you know, than the rest of the African-American population in Arapahoe County, I think this is, I think the record and the files and motions do not clearly establish that Mr. Dotson's claim as it relates to ineffective assistance of counsel is not entirely without merit. In addition, Mr. Dotson did not, you know, just limit his claims as to a Sixth Amendment, United States constitutional arguments. His claims also involve Article 2, Section 16 of the Colorado Constitution, in addition to the Colorado Uniform Jury Service and Selection Act. Those issues were not decided in Washington, nor were they decided in the subpoena. So I think our claims are more expansive than the claims that were raised in Washington. And especially when you have a situation where the statistics in my post-conviction motion include, Mr. Dotson's post-conviction motion included, that the likelihood that this would happen in chance would be 1 in 56 billion, trillion, 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 trillion. I think that's a pretty significant statistic there that should at least give us an evidentiary hearing to explain why this does not count as why it's a violation of the United States Constitution and specifically the Colorado Constitution, because the Colorado Constitution, can have more rights than the United States Constitution. And in the case which was cited in the post-conviction motion, that said it was cited with approval was the Wheeler case in California, which said that, the fair cross-section claim, under the California Constitution, essentially, it's like an ideal cross-section. So I think there's a broader and more rights under the Colorado Constitution than the United States Constitution. And this was not explored by either the Washington case nor the case in Sepeda. Based on those statistics, and specifically based on the statistical measurement which was approved by the Court of Washington of statistical significance, which was clearly proven, alleged in Mr. Dotson's post-conviction motion, I think he at least should have been afforded the opportunity to explain how those statistics resulted in an unfair cross-section based upon the United States Constitution, the Colorado Constitution, and the statutory provisions.
Mr. Lansky, just so I'm clear, the difference between Washington and your client's case is that at the time of your client's case, citizens of Aurora were excluded from the Arapahoe County jury pool. That's what you're saying?
That's accurate.
Despite that, the absolute disparity in the Arapahoe County jury pool was only 1.6%. I mean, there obviously were minorities serving in Arapahoe County juries. So even though that may be, that's an interesting fact, the absolute disparity that the judge found here was far less than the one in Sepeda, which was under maybe a different system. But why couldn't the judge just rely on that as saying, well, this is far less of an absolute disparity, so it doesn't violate the standards of Sepeda, even if Aurora is excluded?
Well, the situation in regards to absolute disparity is that it's been faulted. It doesn't take into account the size of the minority population in that county. If there's a small number of minorities, then the absolute disparity, will not really be relevant or significant or persuasive. There's problems with it, and the problems have been cited in the Washington case and also been cited by the recent United States Supreme Court case, I believe, in Borges and Smith. And they say it's an inaccurate measure. So even though it may have been less than the measure cited in Sepeda and Washington, is still an inaccurate measure. And I think that's why the helpfulness of an expert will come and explain to that, and explain to the judge, these statistics are less than what was previously cited, but there's a problem with these statistics, because if you look at the population, of minorities in Arapahoe County, that they don't take into account of that. And that's one of the biggest faults with absolute disparity statistic measures.
Isn't that exactly what the court in Washington said? I mean, all of that was presented to them in Washington at the end of the day, and they acknowledged that they didn't necessarily say they agreed with the criticisms, but they certainly acknowledged that those were out there. Nonetheless, in their holding, they said, we're going with the absolute and comparative disparities because we find that more persuasive.
Right, I think the court took into account all the statistical measures. And I think they listed the four was absolute disparity, which relative comparative disparity was absolute impact and was statistical significance. And I think the court looked at each of those statistical measures and came to its conclusion. In Mr. Dotson's case, the statistical significance is going to be a lot greater than it was in Washington, for the fact that jurors in Aurora, where the minority population of Arapahoe County was concentrated in, was entirely excluded. And this was excluded based upon no reason or no cause, because they had the testimony of the person from Arapahoe County asking why this was done, and the person said, we don't know why it was done. And again, to distinguish Washington from Mr. Dotson's matter, I am alleging here issues in regards to the Colorado Constitution. I'm also alleging issues in regards to statutory. And again, those were not addressed, by the court in Washington. And I think based on what was stated in Mr. Dotson's post-conviction motion, we at least should have been afforded the opportunity to show why his claims have merit. I don't think the court can conclusively decide without an evidentiary hearing based on these statistics which have been subsequently criticized, and statistics which, you know, don't take into account other statistical measures. I think we should have been afforded that opportunity to go to a hearing. Now, for Mr. Dodson's second claim in regards to the issues that were raised at the evidentiary hearing, I believe it really comes down to the issue of whether or not Mr. Dodson was prejudiced, mainly by his attorney's failure to essentially get the available evidence to show that he, in fact, had possessed this keyboard prior to the date of the alleged robbery. And I submit to this court that if the jury had evidence, heard testimony and saw evidence that, in fact, Mr. Dodson did possess the same keyboard prior to this date, and he could identify distinguishing characteristics of this keyboard, included the memory card, which you can say this data was formed prior to the date of the robbery, and also other ways to distinguish that it was his keyboard, mainly because the key on the keyboard was not broken. I believe if the jury heard this evidence, that it would have, I think there's the probability is sufficient that the confidence of the outcome, cannot be there for the fact that, this was pretty relevant evidence and would have created a basis, for reasonable doubt.
In any event, what prevented the defendant from telling his attorney that in the first place, that he had pre-existing music on the keyboard?
Well, that was one of the issues that was raised in his post-conviction motion, was the failure to communicate. And he said he never really spoke to me. He only spoke to me right before trial. It was very brief.
But he spoke to him, so what prevented him from telling his attorney that? I don't see how, I'm having a problem seeing how what the prosecution did prevented him from telling his own attorney that.
Well, I think the communication was limited.
But didn't the trial court make specific findings that the trial attorney spoke with and had communication with the defendant? And there is record support for that. So, as an appellate court, aren't we bound by that?
But the situation is that, even Mr. Dodson may have had the ability to tell him that. I think if his attorney would have went out there, looked at the actual keyboard and said, hey, this is what he knows about the keyboard, what can you tell me about that? If that investigation was done, then I think, then there could have been more, evidence to show that, in fact, it was a keyboard. Plus, in fact, he had other witnesses who could show, hey, I saw it, aside from the distinguishing characteristics, those other witnesses are available, said, hey, I was there with Mr. Dodson prior to this date of his alleged robbery. This is the keyboard that he used. These are the songs that we played on. And the fact that evidence was presented, I think, again, it will show that he had possession of this same keyboard prior to the date of the alleged robbery.
As I read the record, and I think the trial court made this finding, none of the witnesses would have said this was the keyboard. The most that they would have said was he was using this particular kind of keyboard.
Well, that's it. Even if that was the case, he was using this particular keyboard, that's relevant, and it's exculpatory information that the jury should have heard. The jury would have heard the information, yeah, he had the same keyboard, and the fact this was a common keyboard shows, he was a musician. Again, at the end of jury summation, the prosecution was arguing, he's not a musician. He had no reason to have this keyboard. And that clearly, there was evidence available to show, yes, he was a musician, and he had a reason to have his keyboard, and it was witnessed to show that, in fact, that this keyboard was him. And I think this would have been probative and exculpatory information when you take into account the other weak evidence, that the DA had, which is identification.
How is it weak when the victim himself identified the defendant as the guy, both pre-trial and at trial? That's pretty strong.
Well, circumstances of the ID. The victim initially said he only saw him from a profile. The perpetrator had a hat. His prior descriptions to the police were inconsistent with subsequent descriptions, and those descriptions were in conflict with Mr. Dodson's actual description. But probably the most, shown that the ID is weak is the fact that there was another witness to this robbery who was with the perpetrators, for 5 minutes, and could not identify Mr. Dodson as the perpetrator here. And I think that's why, you know, and a lot of the summation was shown how the identification was weak. In fact, that the photo array was a very bad photo array. That was the issue, one of the issues for direct appeal. And I think that's why the state relied on the property being recovered as the, you know, one of the main parts, components of the evidence. And I think the jury would have heard that Mr. Dotson had the same keyboard prior to the robbery. I think that's the basis for reasonable doubt. I think that lessens the confidence in the outcome of Mr. Dotson's trial.
Testified to that, Mr. Thomas?
Mr. Thomas, as opposed and as to other witnesses who the court said this evidence may have been available as a court.
The judge found that the information about Thomas was received and assessed but found to be of little value by the lawyer. The lawyer testified to that, right?
No, the lawyer did not testify.
What did the judge
and no recollection what he did because the file was destroyed.
What did the judge base that finding on that?
The judge makes its own conclusion based upon, you know, what Mr. Thomas may have stated, but certainly, you know, the attorney never testified as to what he did or what he did not do or why he chose not to call this witness, because the attorney had no recollection of what he did whatsoever in the case.
That's not quite right, is it? I mean, there were some things he did remember and he testified to, and he also testified what his habit practice was in cases like this.
Right, but he had no specific recollection. But what he did remember, if I may, I know I'm past the time limit. If I may, what he testified to was that he remembered going through a discovery, preparing examinations, preparing summations. But as to any specific recollection as to doing any investigative work, he really did not recall any of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lansky. Yeah.
May it please the court, my name is Melissa Allen, registration number 23155, here on behalf of the people. With respect to the first issue, there's been a lot of talk about what may or may not have come from this additional evidentiary hearing. The defense counsel is saying Mr. Dotson should have had, you know, in order to show that this systematic exclusion of these jurors was a violation of the Colorado Constitution. But I would submit that what this hearing wouldn't have shown and what the motion and the briefs do not allege is how in the world defense counsel was ineffective for not raising this issue. The only thing that's even mentioned in the reply brief is, well, he was a trial judge in that jurisdiction for 3 years and handled X number of cases. So what presumably he should have noticed in the composition of the juries coming in, that there was this disparity and that the Aurora wheel must not have been putting people into the Arapaho County wheel. I mean, it's nonsensical.
Counsel in Washington happened to notice that.
I would submit that they didn't necessarily just notice it. I think that when you're talking about a triple homicide, you have a lot more resources and you dig a lot deeper and start looking into all sorts of issues that may not be evident just by being present in a courtroom.
Trial court certainly didn't go down that route.
That's correct. But I don't think that prevents this court from doing that. I mean, the whole idea here is it's the defendant's burden to demonstrate counsel was ineffective. And I've heard nothing being argued other than what these disparities were and how it was this kind of a violation, but nothing about why defense counsel was ineffective for failing to raise this. I mean, taking a step further, does that not mean that every defense attorney who is practicing regularly in that courthouse during this period of time would have also been ineffective for not raising this issue? I mean, I think it begs that question. And I think it's also interesting that while arguing or alleging in the grand scheme of things, because this isn't an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, that Mr. Kirby should have, you know, noticed this by virtue of the fact that he practiced in the courtroom, defense counsel is also saying that he needed to have expert testimony on all this statistical data to show this. So if we need all of this expert testimony and statistical data to prove this point, again, how could it have been so obvious to defense counsel that he was ineffective for failing to raise it in the first place?
The defendant is also implicating appellate counsel, not just trial counsel. Can you speak to that, please?
Yes. Appellate counsel could not, in a direct appeal, obviously, appellate counsel could not have raised this issue on appeal because it was not preserved at trial. And under the statute, 1371.139, the exclusive means by which a defendant can challenge the composition of a jury is by written motion supported by affidavits filed before the jury is sworn. So that was something that couldn't have been raised after that point on direct appeal.
How do you respond to the issue that, yes, the trial court here ruled on the Sixth Amendment claim, but it didn't rule on the claim under the Colorado Constitution? And I can't remember whether it ruled on the statutory claim or not. I thought it did, but I may be wrong about that. But so how do you deal with the question of...
I guess I don't mean to be sidestepping the issue, and I guess in a way I am, but I just don't think it's relevant. It's not what the issue is on appeal. The issue is whether trial counsel was ineffective for failing to raise this. It has nothing to do with the final disposition of whether there was or wasn't this constitutional violation.
Except that's what the trial court held. Trial court held there was no ineffectiveness here because as a matter of law, the defendant loses.
Okay.
So and I guess my question is, what are you saying to us on the question of whether the court was correct as a matter of law on the underlying legal issue?
I think on the underlying legal issue, the court was correct because it followed the Washington case. It took into consideration what defense counsel was asking it to take into consideration with respect to the statistical analysis, and it determined that the disparity was less of a disparity than what was noted in the Washington case. And I think that's where you stop.
Stop there, both from the standpoint of the Sixth Amendment, or just from the standpoint of the Sixth Amendment, or what do you say about the Colorado Constitution and the statutory claim? Are they if the court was correct,
I think it's all encompassed under that ruling.
So if the court was, your argument is if the court was correct as a matter of the United States Constitution, it encompasses the Colorado Constitution as well.
Yes.
Okay.
And I'd like to discuss a couple of the various claims of ineffective assistance of counsel related to the keyboard and kind of the overall idea that defense counsel didn't speak with Mr. Dotson or go over the evidence with him. Really what this comes down to, I think, is the fact that the defendant bears the burden here of letting his counsel know of discrepancies that he sees. And to say that he wasn't aware of them because counsel didn't go over discovery with him, I think is not fair, because Mr. Dotson sat through a preliminary hearing, and then transcript's part of the record. He sat through a suppression hearing where all of this evidence about, you know, where the keyboard was when the search warrant was affected. There's his prime opportunity to say, hey, wait a minute, it couldn't have happened that way. And presumably he never mentioned any of these things to his attorney. More importantly, I think basically, you know, we're hearing a lot of, it would be, I think in the reply brief, defense counsel actually said it would be inequitable to presume counsel performed investigative facts when he said he couldn't recall under certain circumstances whether he did or not. And it's the defendant's burden to prove that counsel did not, and that by doing so, counsel fell below the standard of objective reasonableness. It's not the prosecution's burden to prove that counsel was effective. And I think that we're seeing some burden shifting here that's not proper. You know, the whole idea that this Roland D50 keyboard could have been in the defendant's possession before the robbery, I mean, I think it's a double-edged sword. You know, I know the argument is, well, from the defendant's perspective, you know, he already had this, and I agree with one of the questions that was asked. I don't think anyone was going to testify, and Mr. Dotson did not take the stand, but I don't think anyone else was going to testify that this was the exact keyboard. Because obviously, this man, the victim, was robbed. Someone took his keyboard. He identified the keyboard with the scratch, and he identified the case with the special styrofoam that was inside, and he had a key that fit it. And we had a really strong, I beg to differ, we had a very strong identification by this victim of the defendant, both before and at trial. So it's not like we're looking at it this in a vacuum and we're just wondering about this keyboard. This man was robbed and this keyboard was taken. So which tact do you take as a defense attorney? Do you not talk about another keyboard because you don't want the jury thinking, well, wow, look, he's so into music and he has these other keyboards, and, you know, maybe that gives the jury more reason to think, hey, well, who better to steal another keyboard than someone who knows its value and someone who's interested in music and everything else? I mean, you can't say that the jury is going to, based on all the other evidence, that the jury is just going to take that evidence as, you know, God's word that this keyboard belonged to this defendant before this robbery, so, you know, he couldn't possibly have committed this robbery. I think you just have to look at it. We have to presume that it's sound trial strategy, and I think that that's something. You look like you're going to ask a question.
But it sounds like you're speculating on what the trial counsel's reasons were for not putting some of this evidence in. But you, and that's my question. Are you speculating, or did the trial counsel indicate at the...
No, I'm certainly speculating, because we don't have any evidence as to why it wasn't admitted. But I think to...
We do have evidence. And a lot of generalities here. I mean, the trial counsel at the 35C hearing did testify about certain things that the defendant told him and certain avenues he went down in terms of strategy. It is true that there are certain things that he just simply didn't remember.
Yes. And in fact, I think one of those things that he mentioned was he felt like the keyboard case in particular was kind of more damning evidence, for lack of a better word, than the keyboard itself. And so his focus was on trying to discredit the witness's identification of that, and why he didn't mention certain things about maybe the scratch on the keyboard when he was interviewed before. I mean, he certainly didn't not cross-examine the victim at trial well on all of these issues that now we're hearing would have been so important. And I don't know if the court wants to address the third issue with respect to ineffectiveness at the pretrial suppression hearing. I stand on my brief that this issue wasn't properly before the court because it wasn't really raised in the motion. But more importantly, again, I think the post-conviction motion and the opening and reply briefs fail to demonstrate, fail to give us any idea of what this other evidence would have shown and how it would have demonstrated that counsel was ineffective. It's vague and conclusory, and it doesn't really give us anything. And that's more is required than that, as this court is aware. And unless there are any other questions, I would ask that this court affirm the trial court's order.
Thank you, Ms. Allen. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and opinion will issue in due course.